succession number 31392, reel 5.
Reel 5.
Yeah, just to show you how the Navy work, you spend months and months hanging around, waiting, and then just after being torpedoed, I get 4 days leave, and I'm sent up to docking in Norfolk. And when I arrived there, I was told that, hurry up, it's briefing. And I met my pilot, and within about 5 hours, I was flying on a rover patrol with him, with a strange pilot, over the Dutch coast.
So the rover patrols, were you given a specific area to patrol?
Yes, we had to navigate to the Hook of Holland, and he knew you arrived at the Hook of Holland because they had enormous flak battery there, and they would fire. They'd give you an enormous firework display, so you knew that was the Hook of Holland. And then you would follow the Dutch coast up to Emden, and you could pick out the individual Frisian islands on your radar. You could navigate on the radar like that because you just ticked off the island as you passed them.
And would another aircraft be taking another sector?
No, we would be singly. We would be single. They would send one aircraft after a short time to do a separate patrol, but we were single independent aircraft.
And these were always night time, were they?
Yes, we took off any time from about 11 o'clock at night till 2 in the morning.
Are there any difficulties navigating at night?
No, it's easier in a way. Well, again, as soon as we crossed the coast, we were completely over the sea, so you're getting used to that by this time. And you just did dead reckoning navigation. As I say, you knew when you got to the Hook of Holland because they gave you a firework display, and then you just followed the islands round. And then when you wanted to go back, you had to be sure where you started from, of course, and which we did know by that time, and just make a direct course home. And I was getting quite good at it by this time, so he didn't have any fears for me. I was quite confident, actually, and mainly because I'd always been able to find my way home, which gives you confidence.
Were there any incidents with coastal vessels where you attacked them during this period?
Yes. We invariably got fired at with a lot of ACAC, but as it was at night time, and we were single aircraft, it was very unlikely that we would be hit. And I had a good pilot, but he was very keen, and he did want to make his attacks. And we made an attack. I've got the numbers here, actually. I think I did 16 patrols, each between 3 and 4.5 hours, between the 10th of September and the 15th of October. And we carried 2 500-pound and 2 250-pound bombs and flares. And we only once had the satisfaction of seeing a ship set on fire. But we made attacks on practically every occasion.
What would the method of attack be? What would happen when
a
ship was spotted?
Well, on the radar, I would get the aircraft over the directly over the convoy, and then the pilot would then drop flares, and then he would make a visual attack, and on a dive attack or a shallow dive attack, and he would invariably know where the ships were because they'd all be firing ACAC and a lot of tracer and everything, so he could see where the tracer and everything was coming from. So they would get their position away. Actually, if they didn't fire anything, we would probably have more difficulty in spotting them. But it's highly unlikely that they would hit anything. I think that there were statistics made during the war as to how many millions of rounds of ACAC fire would ensure one hit.
And And once an attack had been made, what would happen then? Would you come straight for home, or would you continue on your patrol?
Well, continue the patrol up to a certain time, and if there was, and you'd go up and down, trying to find there might be more than one convoy, and the important thing was to make the convoy report before you made the attack, because that's what they wanted to know, because we were unlikely to cause much damage, but the rocket bow fighters at dawn would probably decimate the convoy, because they would have 12 rockets each. They would send a whole squadron of bow fighters, each with 12 rockets. So there wouldn't be much left of the convoy if they found it.
And you did that till October. What happened then?
Well, they decided to disband the squadron again. So we all flew to Leon Solent, and I said goodbye to my crew, and went home on leave. And went home on leave to my stayed with my mother in Chingford, and I was glad to get away, because they were sending over flying bombs and V2 rockets, and so I thought, my God, it's dangerous here. And so I was quite pleased when they gave me a rail wander and told me to go up to Scotland again, where it was quiet. And then of course I had to join a ship, the Warwick Castle, SS Warwick Castle, and which landed me in Ceylon. And I found myself in this jungle airstrip called Katakarunda, the metal mesh airstrip in the middle of the jungle. And I was crewed up again on an Avenger with Bob Forth and Guy Gordon, and who I saw the other week. And we were waiting for passing carriers to ask for spare crews. And up came the Formidable, wanted a spare Avenger crew. So we were selected, and we found ourselves on a big 30,000 ton fleet carrier with a 900 foot flight deck.
Can you give me an idea of what it's like to fly from something that big compared with the Nabob?
Well, it's difficult to meet many people because it's so huge. It's like a small town. I think it's about 2,000 people on it. It's very, very hot because it's armoured with steel all round. And, of course, being British, no air conditioning. So it's when you get into the tropics, it's very, very hot and sticky. Anyway, we were destined to join the British Pacific Fleet, and so we didn't stop on the way at all. We just went straight to Australia, Sydney, called there for a short time, and then steamed straight up north to join the British Pacific Fleet, which were doing strikes on the Sakishima Islands to stop any Japanese aircraft reinforcements coming up to Okinawa. The Americans had just invaded Okinawa, and we were keeping the airfields unserviceable by putting holes in the runway, which was a permanent job because they were crushed coral runways. And as soon as we'd gone, the Japanese bulldozers came out and filled the holes in, so we had to go the next day and do it again.
What squadron had you joined?
Pardon?
What squadron had you joined?
Oh, 848 squadron, which was they'd made a bigger squadron. It was 18 Avengers and two squadrons of 18 Corsair fighters. Which were quite formidable aeroplanes.
So on the raid on the Sakishima Islands, would you have fighter escorts?
Yes. Oh yes, we had. But we didn't need fighter escorts because at that time the Japanese weren't putting up much air opposition. Most of their air power was concentrated on kamikazes, bomb carrying, attacking ships, and they weren't. It was alleged that they were holding back their fighters for the homeland in case of an invasion of Japan, and they were keeping their fighters in reserve for that big battle then. And that was the story.
So these operations that you were doing, can you take me through kind of a typical one that you did?
Yes, we would take off as a squadron about 200 miles off from the target, and just fly as a squadron, first of all at low level, so that the radar didn't pick us up too early. And then when we got near, we climbed to about 5,000 feet. And then when the lead plane would then start his dive, and we would all follow and just drop our four bombs onto the runway, and then scoot off home.
Would the runway be the specific target, or would you look for buildings or aircraft?
Yeah, the object was to make the airfield unserviceable, so it was more important to make holes in the runways. Because if the runways were in use, then the planes obviously could land and refuel.
Now, you said it was virtually a daily routine, so at night time then, were the Japanese repairing
yes, the runway? Yes, yes, yes. We didn't do any night operations.
How many airfields were there that you would attack in those islands?
There were three in this particular little section of islands, the Sakishima Islands, Sakishima Group. But there were various others on the way between Formosa and the mainland of Japan. But these were the three main ones, and they would be necessary for refueling to do the distance, because the distances are very, very great in the Pacific. And most of these aircraft we're talking about were single-engined kamikaze aircraft.
Did you experience any kamikaze attacks on Formidable?
Well, they happened after I left the Formidable, because on our third attack on Ishigaki, we got hit by anti-aircraft fire.
Can you take me through that in as much detail, that operation, as what happened?
Yeah, we were halfway down through our dive, and being the fleet air arm, we used to drop our bombs at low level. We instructed 1,500 feet, which is very, very low. And halfway down, we felt quite a shudder in the aeroplane. We thought it was a near miss. And when the pilot pulled out of his dive, he pushed the throttle forward and announced that he had no power in the engine, so he was gliding. So we decided unanimously to try and get him as far away as possible, having heard tales. And so we managed to get 8 miles out before he had to ditch in the sea. I was sending out SOSs all the time, and got a reply, and gave approximate position. We got into our dinghy without any problem.
How did you do that?
Of course, we'd done the practicing many times, so we knew exactly what to do. The dinghy stowage was just amidships, and you had to undo a panel. Being a mid-wing, the aeroplane floated quite well. The pilot and the air gunner's ditching position would be in his turret, because if he was in the back, the door would be underwater. So as soon as we ditched, the pilot got out of the port side, and the air gunner would get out on you'd jettison the side of his turret, so he would get out on the port side. They would both step onto the wing, and that was the side where the dinghy was. So they would take the lid off, pull the dinghy out and inflate it with the CO2 bottle. The way my canopy opened, I had to have to get out on the starboard side. And so I would have a one-man dinghy, I'd inflate that and paddle around to the other side and join them, by which time they'd got the dinghy out upside down. So there's only one way to right a dinghy, that's to get in the water and do it in the water. You can't do it otherwise. So we all had to get wet in the end to right the dinghy. So we all got in the dinghy. Although it wasn't all that warm, it wasn't really cold, the water was reasonably warm in those waters. It was very cloudy and overcast, so we didn't have any sun problems. Matter of fact, we were a bit chilly, if anything. So we got in our dinghy, paddled away, watched the aircraft slowly sinking, and then shortly afterwards we saw a firefly reconnaissance plane from one of the ships fly over us. He didn't see us. I tried to set off a flare and it didn't work. It didn't operate. By the time I got the second flare out, he had disappeared. So we resigned ourselves to a long wait, because we were aware that this was the last of a series of operations, and the fleet would be going back to refuel and rearm, so they wouldn't be able to send any more searches out for us. So we had to make a decision as to what we were going to do. There's one thing we weren't going to do, is to go towards the island we just bombed. And so the next possibility was Formosa, which was 240 miles away. But I had my silk map. Have you seen these silk maps? Yes, I've got one. I've still got it, actually, the one I used. The silk map was telling us that the winds and the currents were taking us towards Formosa, and we were drifting pretty well. So we decided that's what we're going to do. We reckon we'd do about 30 miles a day. So we'd eventually get to Formosa in about a week. And anyway, we were all, three of us were okay, physically. The pilot had broken one finger, but that wasn't very serious. Anyway, we spotted nothing except one Japanese plane, which we didn't bother to signal. And so we settled down for the night. And spend a rather uncomfortable night with waves slapping over and keeping us wet all the time and the wind keeping us cool. We were seasick, but we weren't really downhearted. Anyway, the next day, nothing happened all day again. At about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we had to guess the time, of course, because we didn't have waterproof watches in those days. And about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we were just sort of getting ready for our second night in the dinghy, when I said, there's a plane over there. And it came a bit closer and closer, and it was an Avenger. And then it was joined by several others. And eventually it was a whole squadron, and they were obviously circling to formate. And they made a big circuit. And the last plane flew pretty well over us. And I let off another flare, which worked this time. And he peeled off and flew over us. And it was an American Avenger. And so we waved at him. And he stayed circling around. And 40 minutes later, a flying boat turned up. An American twin-engine Martin Mariner. He landed close by us, hauled us on board, and took us to their base, which was just off Okinawa, and where we offloaded and taken to his mothership, which went by the marvellous name of the USS St. George, which was there for the sole purpose of keeping the flying boats supplied and rehabilitating the airmen that they picked up. He was taken on board, introduced to the captain. He said, "You're the first limeys we've picked up." Gave us everything we needed, of course. Shower, medical check, fresh clothing, chocolates, cigarettes, and $10 to spend in the PX. Being Sunday, yeah, it was Sunday by then. Being Sunday, we had a lunch of turkey and ice cream, even though they'd only captured half the island. And the ship was patrolled by armed sentries who were putting a bullet into every floating thing in case there were Japanese suicide swimmers. Anyway, then the 2 days later, they put us ashore onto this airstrip that they'd carved out and said, "Wait for an aeroplane to take you home." So I said, so we inquired about an aeroplane home, and they said, "We're only going to Guam," which was the opposite direction. So I said, "Oh, well, you're only going to Guam, we'll have to go to Guam." And a DC-4 landed, not a trooping DC-4, an airline DC-4, with all the comforts that had been appropriated by the military. So we flew in first-class comfort to Guam, about 4.5 hours, where we stayed the night, and they said, "There's a plane going to the Philippines where your ship is." They knew where our ship was. "Our ship has gone back to the Philippines. You'll be able to join your ship. So get on the DC-4 tomorrow." And we got to the Philippines the next day, got on board ship, and then we discovered that we were entitled to survivor's leave. And they said, "Do you want to go on the next operation or do you want to go on survivor's leave in Sydney?" So we said, "I think we go to Sydney." So offshore again, and they said, "Find an aeroplane that's going to Sydney," which we did. We found an Australian Air Force plane, DC-3, which was on a mail run. And they took us to Sydney island hopping all the way. It took us about 4 days. And we had our survivors leave in Sydney.
Can I ask you about the ditching? You mentioned briefly that there was a procedure. What was the procedure for ditching? And what was the sensation like when you actually ditched in the water?
Well, it's a very suitable plane for ditching because it's mid-wing and it's got a reasonably slow speed, and the pilot did a very, very good job, and it wasn't much different to an arrested deck landing, which is pretty violent, because when you do a deck landing with a hook and a wire, you come down from 75 knots to standstill in a very, very short distance. So you've got to be well strapped in, and it wasn't very much different to a deck landing, except for the spray.
And you mentioned that you didn't want to roll back to the island for the threat.
Mm.
Can you explain a little bit more?
Well, there'd been rumours circulating around that the Japanese on the more remote islands were prone to beheading captured airmen. And we discovered after the war that was so. And it was true.
So you were aware of the rumours and that, and that you wouldn't want to.
Mm.
Had there been any provision? I know the Americans picked you up there, but was there any provision provided by the British Pacific Fleet for picking up?
Yes. Most of the fleet carriers had one walrus amphibian, which was for air sea rescue, and they could go and pick you up. And they did several air sea rescues actually with the walrus amphibians, even within rifle shot of the islands. So they did have that, which was more than the Americans had. The Americans never had during the war a deck landing amphibian. The only float planes they had were cruiser based or battleship based, and they did away with those towards the end of the war. And their flying boats, of course, couldn't land on carriers. So Britain was unique in having a deck landing amphibian aircraft.
So how did you spend your survivors leavings, didn't you?
Oh, difficult to remember, really. Had a very good time, let's put it like that.
What was the next stage for you after survivors leave, then?
After survivors leave, of course, I had to find a job for us. And they sent us down to Royal Naval Air Station at Nowra, which is 100 miles south of Sydney, which was what they call a fleet requirements unit, mostly target towing for visiting warships. In other words, getting shot at. And not much to do there, really. I just spent a fairly leisurely time there. They made me operations officer of the squadron, which didn't mean very much.
What would it mean normally?
Well, I had my own bicycle, and I did the office work.
So, during this period of time, though, the war in Europe would have ended, did you have any kind of VE Day celebrations out there?
Yes, in actual fact, I spent VE Day on a tiny ship, a sloop, which was about the size of a ship, a fishing trawler, because we were at sea by that time on the Formidable, and they had to take us off onto the sloop to take us back to Leyte on the Philippines. And it was while we were a few days on this ship going back to Leyte that it was announced that the Germany had capitulated. I think we had a beer, which is about as much as they can afford on a small ship.
So at this period in Australia, you were with the Fleet Requirement Unit.
I was about 4 months down there, and then the Americans dropped the atomic bomb and finished the war, and then they couldn't wait to send us home as soon as possible. And
how did you feel about the end of the war?
Well, I was a bit disappointed because I was enjoying myself in Australia. I thought it was going to go on for at least another year. And, of course, it was a bit selfish of me because I had a cushy number there, and I was going up to Sydney every weekend, and I was making plenty of friends, and so it was a bit of a blow. Anyway, they packed us off on the SS Stirling Castle, a 6 week journey home, and
which route did you take
now? Through the Suez Canal, via Ceylon again. So we stopped off at Ceylon, the Suez Canal, Mediterranean, and then home. I can't even remember which port we landed at, and went home, and they really, we were just killing time until we were demobilised. We were sent to various places to get our demobilisation clothing, handing in our equipment, seeing various officials, and when they didn't want to, they asked me if I wanted to stay in. I said no, so they lost interest. And demobilised me, and my demobilisation date actually was my birthday, my 24th birthday in 1946.
One last question then, Bill. How do you feel now about having served with the Fleet Air Army in the Second World War?
Oh, I wouldn't have missed it for anything. And it led to quite a number of other things too, because I was mentioning about these American Avengers that spotted us in the Pacific there. And I still met up with my air gunner. I lost touch with my pilot. I met my air gunner only 2 weeks ago. And we all used to say, I wonder who those Americans were who spotted us, because they just disappeared and went back to their carrier. We didn't even know who they were. And apparently, this American squadron used to have reunions, and they used to say, I wonder what happened to those three Limeys. Well, in 1998, one of these Americans decided, he said, we were looking for these chaps, so we know their names. I'm going to the UK, I'm going to locate them. And he located me.